Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the New Media Show. My name is Todd Cochran, and I want to thank you for joining us. If you're joining us live, if you're not, don't worry. You can always subscribe to the show via iTunes or Zune Marketplace or just about anywhere else you get a podcast, and you can find that information out over at geeknewscentral.com or thenewmediashow.com. Want to welcome Rob Greenlee, my co-host this morning. Good morning, Rob. How are you?
Doing fantastic. I have a little glow. I've been outside in the sun here the last day or so because it was Vlogger Fair with Chris Perillo kicked off yesterday.
Oh yeah, how did that go? Was that well attended, or what was the story with that?
Yeah, Chris had about 1,000 people wow. show up, and he had a bunch of YouTube celebrities that were there, and it was in a big Costco type size warehouse. So, and they had a bunch of exhibitors in there and a lot of the YouTube celebrities coming in there and presenting to their fans and that kind of stuff. So there was a lot of, it was a really kind of fascinating event from the standpoint of who was in attendance, those young teenagers with their parents to technology people, to new media creators. It was just a really fascinating mix of stuff, and is really reflective of, I think, what's going on around content at YouTube. And I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about that in this show.
All right, outstanding. And of course, this morning we want to welcome our guest, Amber J. Lawson. Amber, hang on one second. I think we lost.
Yeah, we did. Not very good timing on that loss.
Yeah, it was the Mac telling me I had to do something. So good morning, Amber. Welcome to the New Media Show.
Hi, Todd. Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So I was reading through your bio, and I was trying to come up with, a lower third for you. So I did IWTV/StoryTech. Is that a good couple of headers for encompassing what you do?
Yes, and then Comedy Gives Back, which is our social benefit enterprise, which I'm sure we'll talk about, content leveraging all platforms globally.
Outstanding. Well, it looks like it's a beautiful day where you are. The sun's just coming up here in Honolulu, I'd love to say it, the trade winds are back, and had a great week in Dallas last week, and we're actually this previous week, got a lot of business done, signed a very, very big deal. We're going to be announcing that in a couple of days or probably this week. I'm hoping we sign it. We can't really let the cat out of the bag yet, but I was telling Rob a little bit about this morning. So I'm very, very excited about the deal that we just signed over at Raw Voice. But that's for another topic and another time. So, Rob, why don't you go ahead and introduce Amber, and I know you had worked getting her scheduled, and if you want, let's go ahead and get right into the questions and content.
Well, let me say that from what I can tell, she is very busy. her full name is, I don't know, what's the best way to spell this out about what you do and what your focus is. I know it's primarily working with people that want to create new content on the internet, but you're working with a lot of the big brands and big media companies and things like that. So how would you kind of classify what you're doing down in Los Angeles is around kind of new media and video production?
I think the easiest way is just to call it a digital strategist. Mm-hmm. So okay. 90% of my time is spent connecting people. So I sit in the middle between, storytellers, whether they be network showrunners or content creators, YouTube stars, whatever that may be, brands, technology, and distribution. And so we will take a deep dive into whatever the issue is, whether it's a studio who has a new film coming out and they created a web series, but then doesn't necessarily have a distribution strategy. So we'll help them with the distribution for that web series. Or a technology company, you know, are becoming media companies. Brands are becoming media companies. And they need to figure out how to create content. Content that has an engaged audience, that envelops their brand, as we like to, as we coined the phrase, brand as character, that emulates their brand, that can be integrated into the content and drive a real engaged audience. And, you know, that's what the internet has to offer today. You know, there's a just an absolute scale of content, quality and engagement that can be leveraged for tune in and buying and experiences. And that's the exciting time we're living in. We're in a renaissance. Viva la renaissance.
Yeah. And then also, I mean, a lot of these projects that you're working on are actually kind of wrapped in some new monetization models. And I know you're involved in kind of creating content that has certain windows of distribution, even on the online era. I know a lot of the broadcast side has always had this windowing concept, but you're playing in this windowing when it comes to online distribution too, aren't you?
Yeah, so about maybe 3 years ago, Michael Eisner, you know, the old chairman and CEO of Disney, spun off a company called Vugaroo. And they launched a series called Prom Queen, and there may have been another moment, but I feel like this was the first successful series that rolled out with the first window being digital, the second window combining all of that content from the first window, and repackaging it and selling it internationally. So Vugaroo created this model, or popularized this model, of a 90-minute movie that's full intention is to be distributed globally. Like, they have a deal with Rogers in Canada. They had a deal with Content Media. Now they're working with Fremantle to distribute internationally. So, but the first window is broken into chapters and released, you know, in chunks of time. So they have distribution deals with AOL and Yahoo. And then most recently, we've seen this successfully done with Anthony Zeiger, who's the creator of CSI's Cybergeddon, which I don't know if you've seen it, but I think it's so well done. And the reason it works, it's an action thriller. Semantic is integrated in as brand as character, like I was talking about before. But these like 9 to 10 minute chapters that it's broken into have a beginning, middle, and end. They leave you with a cliffhanger, they're engaging, and they demand you watch the next episode, which, you know, leads to this next topic of binge viewing. So when I sat down to watch Cybergeddon, I watched the entire 90-minute movie back to back to back to back because it was just that engaging. And I thought it was really excellent storytelling. So, I watched a lot of content, and that's a lot to say for to keep a web expectation, the viewership engaged for that 10 minutes, and then to want to watch more.
So is it made really in a way that could be watched as like one movie too, or is it made really in a way that it has to be watched in each of those you know, those separate episodes? Is there any, I mean, is it made from a long form content perspective, but has like transitions that make it work in a short form as well in segments?
Well, I think it takes a specific storyteller to really put their arms around this format. Okay. because it takes somebody who can see the big picture, the movie version, right? Mm-hmm. And then mm-hmm. be able to break it into act breaks or chapters that are engaging enough to leave you with a cliffhanger wanting to watch more. So, you know, the problem I found, you know, when I was the head of content at AOL, we had a deal where these kind of projects would come to us and they were movies and they didn't work on the platform. And so mm-hmm. we really had to spend some time developing how those chapters would be engaging enough to be a standalone episode on their own. So if you popped in episode 3, that you would be engaged enough to want to watch, and you'd understand enough to have that experience and dig into that one episode. As opposed to, you know, when I got the script, the first 2 pages were like a voiceover, you know, and that's not going to work on the front page of AOL. Right? A voiceover and a visual, as opposed to diving right into storytelling.
I gotcha.
But what is the big difference between storytelling and, you know, because, you know, when someone says to me, I'm doing storytelling type of content, that to me is just producing content. I think it's, you know, it's what's the difference between that and someone that's doing it, a web series or something. I guess I don't fully understand where there's quote unquote a difference in the type of content, or is it just the same type of content? We're just calling it storytelling.
It's the exact same type of content. Storytelling is storytelling is storytelling. So commercials are storytelling, web series are storytelling, movies are storytelling. It's, mm-hmm. you know, telling a good story is the basis of all great content. So that's what we want to do. I think that's the goal for everybody, is to tell a great story.
Now,
I think what you were talking about, though, was as a creator of that content and as a producer of that content, you have to be conscious of a little bit different type of presentation that the online world offers, right? I mean, you have to have, you know, like each separate segment needs to be engaging right out of the gate, and can't, like you say, have like blank screen with voiceover or something like that. It needs to jump right in. So it does, the online distribution piece probably does have a strong impact on that story as well, I would imagine. Well,
I think knowing where you're going to distribute it, you know, your expectations are different if you're going to, say, the front page of a Yahoo versus a Netflix versus going to the movie theater. Yep. You know, it's just like what our viewing expectation is, or our entertainment expectation is, in that medium. You know, now we've been trained that when we go to Netflix, we're open to a, you know, long form experience that can take its time to unfold a bit. Whereas if we're, you know, running across something from a link that somebody tweeted, or that lives maybe on YouTube, that you need to get to it right away to engage the viewer or your audience member in order for the story to unfold. So I think it's the expectation of the platform.
Yeah.
So in your, you'd sent some notes over. In those notes, you talked about monetization. And one thing that, you know, hello? I've worked heavily on is monetization within...
Oops. We're dropping our...
Hello?
Hello.
I lost
you. Yeah, you went somewhere. Yeah. I don't know what happened. Skype having a brain fart. So the question is that you have...
I don't see you guys, though, just so you know.
Oh, that's weird. Do you see us, Rob?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's okay. I guess we're still good. That's odd. All right, so Amber, in some stuff you sent over, you talked about monetization. And, you know, one thing that we've done is, you know, been pretty successful in putting host endorsed type stuff in our audio and video content. But when you're building a story and you're doing a storyline, it's not like you can stop and do advertising within the show. What are you guys doing from an advertising standpoint? All right, how is that fitting in?
Well, so there's there's really four types of kind of funding at the moment. You know, there is, what's the word I'm looking for? It's early on a Sunday for me.
No worries.
Where it's just bought at commissioned. Thank you. Commissioned content, where it's bought outright, you know, licensed. That's something that we've experienced in television forever. Rev share. So it's a completed, piece of property and you just deliver it and share on the revenue, or IFCOM. And IFCOM being, you're going out to advertisers with a distribution partner. And if they're able to secure the funds, then, you know, you get your production money and away you go. So that's kind of the four models in getting your content out. Now getting a brand integrated into the content, you know, that world, that brand world used to be, a very hard nut to crack. And it's still not easy, right, to find a brand that is willing to invest in content, specifically unproven content, in order, you know, to fund it. The piece that they want at the end of the day is reach. You know, at the end of the day, they want to go, how many eyeballs did I touch? The learning that's happening is not just touching, but having an experience that almost a lifestyle, right? At a lifestyle experience that has the audience, the fan, the person engaged in the content, in the brand essence that then moves them into being a lifelong user of that product. One thing I want to note here that has evolved from specifically the YouTube space around finding brand dollars for content is this platform called Open Slate. Have you guys heard of this?
I think I have, but just barely.
Well, I happened to sit on the board, so I was there through the evolution of it. And what they've come up with is like a slate score, is what it's called. And it's like a clout for online video. So what it's doing is giving you almost like a credit rating, right?
Oh, okay.
Where you fit in the scale of engagement. So it goes beyond reach. It goes into how engaged is your audience? Who are you reaching? The demographics, the psychographics. So that this whole area, the advertisers were not buying in. They didn't know it existed, and they didn't realize the amount of down and dirty, awesome engagement and real conversion that they could get from these people they hadn't heard of before. And so what the Slate score did is open up and say, oh, they get this much engagement to this audience. They understand that and can buy it. And so that's been a great tool in being able to monetize the middle kind of content. So it's not, you know, cats flushing toilets, and it's not, you know, the rerun of whatever your favorite, you know, NBC or ABC show is, but it's the online web series, the Lizzie Bennet Diaries, the things that people are rabid for, but maybe the advertisers aren't aware of yet. So it's creating awareness for that kind of middle content.
So do you get involved in any kind of, with Slate, different formats of making advertising and sponsorship, you know, available and presented in that content? Is it, you know, is it product placement? Is it the overlay? Is it pre-roll, post-roll? I mean, does this organization get involved in offering what is maybe best for a particular series to reach that audience, or is it linked up with, you know, demographics, or is it just purely like a ranking score?
It's purely the roots of the company are based in branded entertainment. So it is in their DNA to kind of help facilitate and connect the dots and do big deals. But the idea of the platform is for it to be turnkey, that you are connecting, you know, two people who didn't know each other existed or had a similar need and helping them do a transaction.
I gotcha.
So it kind of gives them like the seal of approval and then, you know, creates awareness for the brand. And then hopefully, you know, with very low touch and with the intention of being an automated transaction, is that they do a deal, whether it is a full-on integration or whether it's just an overlay or display advertisement or, you know, a shout-out if they're vlogging or, you know, whatever is appropriate for their show.
Oh, okay. So it's, like you said, it's a lot like a clout score or something like that, right? Is that
Exactly like a clout score, right? It aggregates all the kind of information around your content and then spits out a number.
Very cool.
That's actually fascinating. So is it open to any online content provider to get involved in that score?
Well, if you're on YouTube, you're on it. And what you should do is claim it. So you go in and make your account more robust. If you're not on YouTube, I actually don't know. I'm not on the day-to-day. I just advise and connect. But I don't know if there's another way in. But they're, you know, there to help the, you know, connect the content creators and brands. I mean, they're looking to monetize content, which is awesome.
You know, one thing that we don't have to worry about, you know, is having to, at least on, you know, creating my type of media that I do, so I don't have to worry about going out and getting a show paid for. You know, my production costs are very, very low, which allows me to be, you know, independent, not have a big staff, get away from that whole big media model where you have to go out and raise a ton of money to do your project and then at the same time be able to earn an income. You know, I earn a living off my content. And if I had to hire two or three people and I had to hire someone to come in and basically sell a series, I would be done. There would not be enough dollars left over to survive. And I think that's a big problem we're seeing with a lot of YouTube folks is they're creating a lot of great content, but such a small percentage of them are earning any form of income. You know, they may get a small check from YouTube, $100 or something like that. That doesn't even pay your electricity bill. So, you know, I guess the question is, you know, is this, you know, the monetization model is being successful to pay a staff and be able to do this content without, you know, having a series that's in the black. You know, that would be my concern is, you know, because it almost sounds like it's old style models being applied to new media. Am I wrong there?
Well, I think those four models that I laid out are have been what media has used across the ages. The great news is that the cost of production has been lowered immensely, right? You can shoot videos off of your smartphone, edit them, and post them to YouTube in a matter of minutes.
Amber, that's not the type of content that's going to be on a serialized storytelling video. You're not going to be shooting it with your iPhone, are you?
You could. I mean, if you look at Lizzie Bennet Diaries, it's a vlog. It's one camera in an apartment shooting a girl, and they raised, you know, $500,000 on Kickstarter. So there are new platforms out there to enable it. So yes, it depends on what you want to do, right? If you want to go do a sci-fi series and, you know, it has to have a budget of X, Y, and Z, you're going to have to go out and raise some money.
Right.
But we do now have tools that allow you to express yourself, put the story you want to tell out there for, you know, pennies on the dollar as it used to be,
right,
build an audience, and then demand somebody pay for it. You know, that's the awesome opportunity of this. And the other piece of it is when you have an audience like that, then the YouTube dollars come in,
right,
the traditional media comes knocking on your door, like Smosh. You know, Smosh is the number one YouTube channel. They built that slow and steady from the get-go. I remember when these guys in 2007, 2008 were making these goofy videos, and they converted it into 10 million subscribers now on YouTube. So they're making buckets of money, and now they're going to be doing television shows. So it's where the audience is. They have a built-in audience, just like Annoying Orange. You know, he's able to merchandise that. He has shows, and he's able to still make money off of his YouTube channel because he built that audience.
You know, Rob, it's what's interesting is that there still is this separation when it comes to, it seems like YouTube is it from a distribution standpoint when it comes to video content creators. It just drives me crazy because you and I both know of all the other distribution channels. You know, you look at this show. When this show goes up, it'll go up on the Roku box. It'll go up on via our own channel, not YouTube's channel. It'll go up on Google TV, Samsung Smart TV, Apple, you know, be on all these devices, you know, 100+ devices that's being consumed. Plus, it'll be up on YouTube. So, Amber, are you seeing the content creators, you know, focusing hardcore on YouTube, or are you starting to see them start to say, okay, there's other places to send this content? I know there's television, that some stuff, a few percentage, you know, a few micro percentage points of shows would get picked up for that. But, you know, where do you see distribution at from the content-wise?
Well, thank you for teeing that up, because that's exactly what the hubbub is about right now. The trend right now is to figure out, where am I going to move my audience from YouTube so YouTube doesn't have, the death grip on me and my audience.
Yeah, exactly.
At the end of the day, you know, there are multi-million-dollar businesses being built on the back of YouTube.
Right.
And even though that is the promise of YouTube, to be a platform that, you know, people can build off of, it could be taken away with a swipe of a whatever, right? And so that is the mass movement happening. And I don't know if you saw the announcement on Tuesday, but Jason Calcanis at the Stream Conference, you know, outed Maker has been creating a platform. So Maker is a multi-channel network who has, you know, aggregated a whole bunch of YouTube channels in various verticals. And together, they are able to up the CPM within their network. So that's the idea of a MCN.
Well, that's
And you know, they're all built on YouTube channels. And so Maker is now building a off YouTube network. We don't know what that means quite yet. And also, a while back, The Collective bought Metacafe and are giving content creators an alternative to YouTube. And you know, Blip has been around for a very long time.
Yep.
And at the New Fronts, they're getting into original content. But they are also an alternative specifically for web series distribution. But to your point, now is the opportunity for the land grab across all devices. And I've met this company called Beachfront Builder. And what that does is builds an app. It pulls in your feed from wherever, whether it's Brightcove or YouTube or whatever you're using, creates an app, and then puts it across all platforms. So iOS, Android, connected TV, Xbox, everything that you are saying, of distributing the content that is their own channel, that they can own their brand and their audience across all devices.
Mm-hmm. You know, which Rob, I think
is the mass movement.
What's funny is here is we did it the other way around, you know, because, you know, Amber, I don't know if you know, but, you know, we built our network first. Mm-hmm. And then brought the content creators in. So, you know, we did this in 2005 by building our own destination point, and it's worked very successfully. And we've been, while people are trying to monetize, we've been dumping, well, quite literally, millions of dollars of advertising since, you know, early 2005 have been going into our verticals that we figured out, you know, we just really did not want to have rely on someone else to, you know, control our branding. So it is interesting now that these brands are starting to become successful on YouTube. They're saying, oh, I need to get off. Our goal from the very get-go was to have our own brand and have our own control. It's almost like it's going in reverse, isn't it, Rob?
Yeah. Well, it's it's really fascinating, because I think what's going on here is exactly what's driven the popularity of apps, right? Each of these media companies is creating their own apps for Xbox and for Roku and all these set-top boxes. And I think that is a big movement that's moving kind of away from YouTube. Because I think the problem with YouTube, and Amber, jump in here and comment on this, but is that the impression that YouTube has is not as conducive to highly produced professional content. So I can see where a brand would be concerned about that. If they're trying to produce some highly, you know, more like TV-like content, and to put it all out on YouTube is probably not the best strategy for them in the bigger picture of things. They probably want to own their own apps. They want to own their own experience and not be at the whim of Google and YouTube to control that entire experience. And I think that's probably what's going on here. So we may see this movement back away from YouTube. And though it's going to continue to be this massive distribution and usage property, but it's going to live in the world that it is natively going to live in, and that's more user-generated content.
But at the same time, Rob, the challenge they're going to run into is YouTube has been hosting that video bill so far. And they haven't, and as soon as they try, unless they use the YouTube embeds, which I would seem a little weird, they're going to all of a sudden find out the true cost of this video delivery. And if you're trying to deliver a million video views over your own network without the YouTube infrastructure behind, all of a sudden, ka-ching, comes in a $10,000 hosting bill. And you better have some serious dollars in advertising coming in behind it in order to support that. Now, the folks over at Maker, I'm sure they're going to have no problem. But also, if I remember correctly, they have a bunch of venture funding as well that they can burn through to make that happen. I think our goal from the beginning was, we knew that the audio content, and in our opinion, the audio content is still king from a money-making standpoint, largely because it's cheaper to deliver, it's easier to monetize, people have more time to listen than to watch. And while I think it's cool for networks, I think it's important for networks to have their own app, I think it's the key word there is networks. The key is a mm-hmm. group of shows, not one-offs, because I'm not going to load an app for a single show. I'm going to load, if Maker has an app, I'm going to load their entire app. But, you know, our stats from what we see in with the 15,000 content creators that we work with, and again, it's a little different space than the YouTube serialized content space, is people are watching via their web browser. They're not watching via apps. So it's kind of an interesting, and it's going to shift, obviously, with time, but
Well, I see that there's the opportunity now for brands. So, and by a brand, I mean anywhere from Ray William Johnson and Smosh to this Forefront app, which is like you're saying, a combination of so it's all hip hop artists, right? So all combined into one app. So you're driving engagement from multiple sources. But to do this land grab, because it's so cheap right now, right? So you are able to brand, you're able to be in people's pockets,
right?
And to push notification to them and and have that brand recognition across all their devices, which I think is key. The kicker, right? What was always the barrier to entry as a person who touched content and content creators all the time is, yes, they want to be on devices, but it's a, you know, the entry fee to create a, and develop an app is like 50 grand or 20 grand maybe now. But then what they don't realize, okay, so you invested that. Maybe people will, you know, download it or install it. Then you have to keep up the maintenance of it and create a whole nother one across another platform, which is another 20K or 50K on each of those devices. Now that's what's so cool about this Beachfront Builder is it puts you in all those places at no cost. It's all about usage. So, you know, it's like the Amazon model. It just scales up as people scale up and you share in the revenue, which I think is so accessible, especially to that YouTube audience, right? The YouTube creators who may not have 20K to drop on a custom app at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, I well know the cost of maintaining apps across multiple platforms because we do that for companies as well. And what we have found is that, well, over time, we've had some change of opinion, to be honest with you. We're not building a lot of apps for platforms right now because people are still, in large part, on their mobile devices going to properties by their browser, on their thing. They're going to www, whatever, they're going to what they're used to. Maybe I'm not seeing, of course, it could be different with these groups, but I do not see people using a high utilization rate of apps. So if this Beachfront folks have got a pay as you go or as a utilization, that's smart, because if your usage isn't that high and people are still coming to your property via the web most of the time, then at least the barrier to entry is low.
Well, and so like Epic Rap Battles is a perfect example. You should download this app. So Epic Rap Battles across all platforms, they've got tons and tons of downloads. They're at the top of the, you know, iTunes store with this app. And now they're able to monetize their content beyond the, you know, YouTube dimes. They're able to get $15 to $20 CPMs in mobile, which YouTube is not able to deliver right now. So not only are they owning their audience, but they're able to monetize it at a much higher rate.
Yeah, 15 to 20 is pretty average for, not for YouTube, but for what we see in the podcasting space.
Right, but I'm talking, specifically the YouTubers. Yeah. Because, again, they're concerned. They're trying to figure out how to make their leap off of YouTube to create other revenue streams.
So when I came to their website then, they're still using YouTube as their main embed, so their app does something different then. They're driving the content into the app from a different location than YouTube. Am I correct?
They're using YouTube, but they're able to monetize within the app. So, you know, the YouTube rules are something like, you know, you can't monetize a YouTube stream, but if you're aggregating your social media, if it does something different and video is a component, you're able to do overlays on top of the content in the app.
Gotcha. Or advertising within the actual content. Yeah, makes sense.
So are these folks moving completely off of a YouTube, or they just kind of want to create a parallel distribution model that leaves them less vulnerable to the whims of Google and YouTube?
Yes, exactly. So Smosh is the perfect example of this. And Barry Blumberg, who is the, you know, CEO, president, head of Smosh, whatever, head Smosher, was really smart and calculated in how he built this brand with the guys. And simultaneously, as they were building their YouTube presence, they built Smosh.com. So they consistently push between the two, and And so their Smosh.com is getting, you know, comparable traffic to their YouTube. And they're not looking to turn their back on YouTube, but they've created an insurance policy, right? That they're able that if something yeah. should go awry on the YouTube platform, that they have that to they still have a hub and a natural environment where their audience is used to hanging out besides YouTube.
And Amber, I know you can't see this because you don't have video feedback right now, but we have the Smosh website up and I had it up on the screen. But what we're seeing, Rob, one thing I do that's different between the Smosh site and then the Epic Rap Battle site was that the Smosh folks have their own video embed. So it looks to me like at least they are having to, you know, they basically obviously have their YouTube stuff, but they've got a parallel, you know, their own video stream, which allows them yeah. then not to have to follow any of the YouTube rules. So they can actually probably mix that content up a little different on their own website, which is smart. But again, mm-hmm. they're definitely incurring the cost to deliver that video then. So if, you know, if they can get the CPM rates, even a $20 CPM rate, on video delivery, depending on how long the content is, that's still pretty close to break even on just a cost to deliver. So it is an interesting, you know, that's, you know, I've done the math on this and I know exactly what it costs to deliver media. Even if you're doing, you know, high terabytes of data, it's still, there is a base cost to move it. So it's curious to see how these folks are going to work this out. Cause you know, that's what I look at it from a bottom line. From my perspective is what we, obviously the with the audience comes good things and comes great sponsors, but also you got to figure out how to pay to deliver it.
Yep.
So.
And I'm sure they're getting higher CPMs because of really what they're able to deliver right. for an advertiser. In fact, I think at that same stream conference, Barry was talking about they did a campaign for, I want to say Halo or, you know, some game. And their deal was to deliver 3 million video views. And to date, they've delivered 21 million. And so, you know, they don't get paid beyond right, that right. that 3 million. And so they are trying to figure out ways that they have, you know, other monetization or bonus or whatever built yep. into that. So they're able to make more money off of it. And what, you know, and clearly it was successful.
And we see a lot of the bottom feeders coming in trying to buy up that remnant inventory. And you know, and in all honesty, it's stuff that you see on late night television advertising that I personally don't want in my content. And you know, nothing's going to alienate your audience more as if all of a sudden, you know, you've delivered the 3 million. Now let's go ahead and reprogram the content and the extra 18 million we're going to outsource. And then all of a sudden you end up with some disgusting ad on your content that doesn't, it's just going to alienate your audience. So there's a fine line. And trying to figure out how to sell that remnant inventory. And it's, you know, I think what'll happen is it'll all work itself out over time. And as the media buyers start to buy more digital, but boy, I wish they'd buy a lot more digital because there's a lot more out there to monetize that is not being monetized. Now, where do you see that space? Because the media buyers have been slow. And in my opinion, they're starting to speed up and they're starting to get yeah. hot on it. But in my opinion, they've been slow to this space. Have you got any yeah. thoughts on that?
Well, I think that it's been a bit of an education, right? Because it's just more detail, right? Yeah. Because there's so much information, it almost makes it too many choices. You know, they say only narrow it down to three choices and people yeah. can hone in and make a decision, right?
Yep.
There's so much information, which we as online folk think that that's great. We're giving you all this information. Now you know exactly who's watching and right. when and for how long and how engaged they were and what did they do and da da da. But that's like too much information. And so it was so overwhelming that it was like, I don't want to do, I need to know what I know where I can check the boxes and I can make decisions and I know what I'm going to get in return. Right.
Yeah. you know, one of the, without revealing too much, one of the deal that we signed last week involved a major player in the media space, and they have a series, a large number of podcasts that supplement their media brand. And one of the challenges that they've had was to have accurate measurement. Now, luckily, we've had a source in, or a solution in place for a long time that actually measures, quote unquote, the podcast media. Now, it's YouTube media measurements and all stuff. That's all a completely separate analytic system. And, you know, YouTube's got that covered. But we were looking at the streaming slash downloadable media, and basically over a year went through negotiations and vetting and everything else. And what it really boiled down to ultimately for us in cinching the deal was that they really didn't care what the number was. They just wanted to know what the number was. And we were able to deliver them the number within a few, within, you know, half a percentage point of exactly what was happening with their media, who was watching it, listening, who, where they were coming from, what type of device, and so on, and break down that data, which we do in our media analytics system. And that really cinched the deal, because they would talk to some of the big guys in quote unquote the space that are claiming to have solutions. In the end, their solutions were a lot of a hyperbole. They were, you know, okay, we'll take a, you know, base. It's like a Nielsen type thing. It's almost like guessing. And so
well, that's what they're used to, right?
They're used to guessing. And we were able to deliver within, you know, their specifications, what they wanted, and it would cinch the deal for us. And we'll have a major announcement again, probably next week, or maybe the week after. But the main thing for them was they just wanted to know what that number was, so that they could report that back to their advertisers. Because the last thing you want to do is have an advertising deal where you've reported, okay, I've reported 5 million engagements or 5 million views or 5 million downloads, whatever it may be, and that number to be inflated because it drives the ROI numbers get skewed, and everything else can really be affected there. So I think we feel good about our data. They felt good about it and moved forward. But it really, what the advertisers, and from talking with media buyers really across the country over the past 6 or 7 years, is even though we have these great analytics, they're still willing to take and trust stuff that's coming from ComScore and stuff that's coming from Nielsen and pay millions of dollars for advertising based on someone sending in a little piece of paper saying, yeah, I watched this television show. I think our model is great, but I wish that the traditional media would be held to the same standard that the digital is, because once it does, then the playing field is going to be leveled immediately.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of history keeping it as is keeping it in place.
Yeah. Well,
a lot of this, a lot of that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But it's evolving, probably, you know, we're getting there, and you know, I've been in this space for a really long time, and just to see how the buys have matured, how reporting has matured, and I'll say this, you know, the new fronts this year, advertisers were out in droves, and each of the new front experiences or shows or presentations were maxed out. They were 100%, 110% full. People wanting to experience and see what the offerings were. And so people are rabid to buy this space. Unfortunately, I think the missing at the new fronts this year was it was acting too much like television and not owning its awesomeness of being digital.
Are you talking about the IAB New Fronts? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. Yes. For me, I do believe that, you know, content is moving across all platforms, and it's just called content. It doesn't need to be called digital content or television or whatever, right? But that but the I feel like the missed opportunity this year specifically was to embrace our awesome digitalness and the specificity and audience that digital delivers. What the actual offerings were, as opposed to, you know, the sparkly content that, you know, that's going to be projected in a linear fashion. So that was what I thought the missed opportunity was. Where is the community around it? What audience are you delivering to me? And what is my opportunity as an advertiser? Those right. were the things missing in this year's New Friends. I will have the caveat that there were some very excellent offerings. I think that, you know, Hulu always does a slam dunk. Blip was super specific and right on. And then Google really did a twist. And basically admitted they had it all wrong. That last year, you know, they had projected this whole TV thing, and mm-hmm. By doing the investments in the channels of traditional content creators, and now this year they really focused back on their YouTube natives as mm-hmm. the tentpole and the stars of the platform.
You know,
that's fascinating, isn't it, Todd? That's what happened here.
Yeah, and you know, and I think what's you know, and I see, you know, when I went to NAB, obviously it's more of a show about the gear, but you know, when you're dealing any content creator that is trying to break out needs to understand, go to some of these shows where the biggies are, and see what is expected. The average content creator like us, the production values have gotten to the point that are so high, audiences expect so much, you know, that's starting to shift into the digital space. And unless you can deliver, you know, and that was one of my goals of going to NAB last year, was to look at some tools to, you know, up the game a little bit. And, you know, it's just simple stuff, graphics and, you know, just different technology you can employ. You know, I hate to say it, but we're competing with those spaces. But yet, even without that polish, you look at there's channels on YouTube that are driving 2-3 million views. They've got these huge engaged audiences. Those content creators are being very successful. But at the same time, you've got probably some that are in the middle of the road. They're delivering great content that probably have more audience share than some major television shows that, you know, are aired weekly.
And that's what that slate score from Open Slate is all about, is defining those engaged audiences and teeing those up to brands. The other thing I would add to this is, you know, part of what StoryTech does, my company with Brian Seth Hurst and Lori H. Schwartz, is we've partnered with CES. You brought up NAB, and that, I think that's right. A perfect example of where content creators should go. So there's a huge movement in CES to have content creators. It's where the IAW TV Awards is, and it's where StoryTech, where we announce the trends for the year. So we'll do the 2014 trends, and then it will correspond to a tour, a floor tour of CES. And I have to admit, like, I've gone to CES for years, but have been absolutely intimidated by the floor. Like, I am a content person first, and technology has become part of my DNA over the years, but it's not what I'm like immersed in all the time or until now. And so Lori H. Schwartz has been doing these tours on the CES floor for years, one of the first people to take brands around. And so StoryTech has institutionalized this, doing contextually relevant tours of the floor. So taking out the Ross Levinsons of the world and Peter Guber and Hallmark and Oakley and content creators from a content perspective of why that technology is relevant and what the tools are, like you're saying, they can use to distribute their content, to up the quality of the content, to create more engagement with the audience. So there is so much more opportunity, especially leveraging technology now. You know better than anyone on how to build that audience and engagement.
When we first went to CES the first time, Andy McCaskey and I, we went without cameras. It was our first year going. And, you know, we were doing interviews with audio recorders hanging off our belts, which was which we learned very quickly was not going to work. It was okay. But, you know, CES is very much a visual experience. And when we went back the following years and started building our rapport and doing some stuff with NBC Universal and groups like that, the visual context of the show was where it really kind of where it hit the road. And what we found was an interesting dynamic, and it's something that I use in my media package every year. I think last year, what did we have, Rob? We had 20 some people at the show, 21 yep. people. So, you know, the floor teams are out. We had three floor teams. The three floor teams are out getting interviews, you know, and doing typical geek stuff. We're you know, this my forte is tech, talking tech and everything around it. And of course the network has all tech stuff. So it was really reaching that geeky techie crowd. But what we found was that while the live, because we were live over just outside of North Hall, we were live and bringing guests on, you know, while we get great numbers doing live, what we find is where the money hits the road is when we get done with the show and we start producing content and putting it online. You know, that content is basically the gift that keeps on giving for a whole year or even longer sometimes. But, you know, I might drive 400,000 or 500,000 live video views during the show, but we'll drive 60 to 70 million post-show views of the content. So while we're reaching the audience, we're trying to at the very time when it's live, we can also take the content then and put it up in digital format and post-produce. It's a very powerful marketing package because, you know, now I have people begging me every year, we want you to come see us. We want, and basically book out, we have to turn companies away because we only have so many slots that we can put companies in. I think CES has done a fantastic job in understanding that dynamic. They were the first convention to have a blogger room. Now there is no blog room. It's combined with the press room. So press mm-hmm. and bloggers are together, which they should have been from the beginning. But very few other shows truly do that. One in point, E3 is coming up. They are anti-blogger. It's almost impossible.
You know, that show's locked down. That's for sure.
You know, unless you know Uncle Harry who knows Tom at E3, you're not getting credentialed to go to E3. They are, you know, and it just blows my mind. CES got millions and millions of vendors, got millions and millions of views from groups like your folks that were on the floor, from us, Gizmodo, everyone else that is there, TechCrunch, Twit and Leo Lepore, all his team, millions and millions of views. But yet when you try to go to E3, they're like, no, why? I don't understand why these conventions are already in trouble with the way media is changing. So, the question is, why would a show like E3 turn away this free and valuable asset? I just don't understand it. I really don't. And I think most shows have opened up, but that show specifically hasn't.
I don't know. I agree with you. I think it's a bit of an old mentality of like trying to keep everything under the hood and, trying to drive people buying passes to the show.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And keeping that exclusivity. But I think that's a very lack point of view as opposed to an abundant point of view and the free marketing that comes from that.
Right.
I think it's a missed opportunity.
I want to switch gears here a little bit and talk. Whoop, we lost you.
We lost Amber again.
She's still there, but the video's gone. Amber, are you still with us?
Nope. Yeah, she completely dropped.
Yeah, so hopefully she'll dial back in here in a second. Well, that was weird.
Yeah.
Just disappeared.
Yeah, it was a bandwidth error, I think. Yeah, I think it's really fascinating what's happening. I think that the whole kind of video space down in that's happening down in Los Angeles and LA and the whole Hollywood scene is really in a state of panic and transition right now. And I'm not sure that, you know, they seem to be running off in a lot of different directions, but it doesn't feel like it's really settled down yet. It seems to be really kind of a wild and crazy world now of people experimenting and trying different things.
Amber, I know you're back. It's good old Skype. One thing I wanted to, I know you've done the IEW, you started the IEW TV stuff. And it's kind of interesting. You and I both have something original here. I started the podcast awards back when the podcasting space took off. And every year we do basically an event. It's a pretty big event, draws from and ours is all audience participated. It's basically audience nominates, then the audience then votes. And then it's truly an engagement type of award system. And last year we've done it, our awards ceremony online. We've done them at different events. Last year we did it at New Media Expos, where we did the award ceremony last year. And kind of funny, it's coinciding at the same time at CES. By CES, you're doing the IEW TV awards at CES. So talk about the origination of it. And I guess the question is, why CES?
So I guess 2.5 years ago, CES is repped by UTA, and UTA has been and Brent Weinstein have been big supporters of the IAW TV Awards from its inception back in 2009. And one thing that so after the IAW TVs and Streamies split, one of the things that the membership was asking for is a neutral territory to have the awards. They felt it was too LA or New York centric. And so when CES came to us, it seemed like the perfect solution. You know, it's technology. So most of us are based on a new platform, right? And using new tools that are kind of at the bleeding edge of technology and content. So why wouldn't you be at the you know, consumer electronics show where they're announcing the next phase of this? And the other piece is that the one thing that CES and the exhibitors are missing is content.
Right.
So we are definitely a pipeline of that content to show their technology off. So it's been a great partnership. They have been fantastic to work with. They gave us space this year. We had it at the Venetian Theater. It was gorgeous. We celebrated, you know, studio projects as well as web series. You know, Squaresville and what's the drama? Leap Year, both winning, which are independent productions, as well as Bill Maher on Yahoo and the other, you know, studio series. So everybody was celebrated across the board. And that's the goal of the IAW TV Awards, really, is for creators by creators. And celebrating the space.
I'm sure we've got a lot of people that will be watching or listening to this that have no idea what IAW TV is. Can you talk a little bit about the organization, how they can join? Because, you know, it seems like each space ends up having two or three organizations. Can you talk a little bit about how folks can get involved with IAW TV?
Sure. The IWTV stands for International Academy of Web Television, and it is a nonprofit professional organization for people in the web space, content creators, executives, development people, and advertisers, distribution. And so it's open. The membership is open to anybody in the space. And I think it's $90 a year to join. And there are various events throughout the year. There's a producers group that gets together. I think Tim Street, who you've had on, tends to lead that. And then Bernie Sue does a writers group, where you'll bring your concept in, and there'll be, you know, 10 different writers in the room, and they'll share their, you know, ideas, tips, and solutions to help build out web series.
I see.
So it's a for the community, by the community kind of movement.
Very cool. I see there's the website now is currently going through a revamp. Any timeline on when you guys are going to be back online with that?
Yeah, we have some big announcements coming up within the next month. So the website will be back up, and the IAWTV Awards site will be back with all those announcements. So they're rehabbing all of that right now. But I believe there's a button in there for info. People yep. can click through, and we can get them signed up.
Rob, you know, one thing that is always a challenge in these organizations and what we found in the early days, remember our yeah. attempt is it was yeah. a lot of personalities. It's nice to see, and I think the challenge is with any type of group like this is to, it's nice to see when you're organized, got nice bylaws, everything's set up, there's a certain way of doing things where everyone feels they can participate is important. So I'm yeah. looking forward to seeing your guys' website back online and reading more about what you're doing. So what's the plans for the 2014 show? That's fast approaching. It's probably planning is already underway, isn't it?
It's funny you should ask that, because I need to ask you some questions offline. we are in the middle of a partnership that we're putting the finishing touches on, and so we look to announce that next month.
Oh, good, 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 good.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Rob,
yeah, that's great.
Amber, you know, one thing I like is when I, you know, get to talk to folks that have this broad spectrum. It's just, you know, it's pretty incredible, because we, you know, I've been stuck in this, how should I say it, this space, this new media podcasting space for so long, and not having really paid too much attention to the, you know, the true, I guess, you know, it's kind of all intermixed, because we've been doing, you know, web video has been online for years and years and years. There's yeah. lots of stuff in online. YouTube is yeah. obviously the king of where everyone goes to get content, but I don't necessarily go there to get serialized content. We know that they're trying to make it that, you know, where people can find serialized, and it's nice to see this evolution of Maker and everyone else putting their own brands together and having their own, you know, destinations and apps and everything else. So we're kind of getting to a point here where something's got to happen. What's next? Where do you see this whole space going? You know, over, you know, money aside, because we know more money has to come into the space. But money aside, where do you see this going? I think I'll throw just my prediction in, because as a prelude, you know, I have a daughter's 22. She doesn't have a TV. She has a laptop. She gets all her media from her laptop or desktop. And, you know, I don't think she'll ever have, maybe when she has kids, maybe she'll get a TV subscription for Barney or whatever. And we know that the television is not going away. They're a multi-billion dollar industry. Anyone that thinks we're going to usurp them anytime soon is kidding. But where do you think this space is going, and where do we fit in with the whole media consumption? That's a big question.
That's a huge question. Yeah.
Well, what I think is happening, and where it will go, is new storytellers are going to emerge. We're having niche programming, and you know, my biggest thing was always, I'm not going to want to wake up on a Sunday morning and program my viewing experience. So I think my generation, until we die off, that TV is probably not going anytime soon. Right. And that programmed, remote is not going away. But the interesting thing is, you know, my viewing habits have definitely changed. I'm watching Netflix or whatever on my television, And I am programming that, like with Arrested Development, and I am binge viewing.
Yeah.
I think there will be brands of content that will emerge or be reborn. I mean, we're seeing the rebirth of a series. So it will be content for content's sake, great storytelling that will attract an audience. The great news now is there are more platforms to discover it. And I think a great example of this is Downton Abbey. So everybody who was part of the Emmys screening process got the, you know, DVD and was all hubbubbing about it. But the genius move they made was by putting the season on Hulu, and other people discovered it. And hence in season two and now season three and beyond, they have this huge groundswell audience. It's the biggest movement in Masterpiece Theater ever, right? That's the biggest audience they've ever had. So I think great storytelling will emerge, and it will just be discovered on different platforms, and we'll consume it on different platforms.
And in the end, it's all about the content. I just love Kickstarter, because you look at what you used to have to go beg for money. So if you have something that is viable, you have an audience, you know, and the audience wants more, you know, you don't have to go beg some producer in some stuffy office someplace. You can ask your audience, hey, I'm going to put up a Kickstarter. Let's see if we can fund this. And those that have great content will rise to the top for sure. But I think there's a huge opportunity, not only for that upper crust, but there's also a great opportunity for the folks in the middle to really get out there. You know, how many minutes of video are being uploaded, or how many hours of video are being uploaded to YouTube every minute? There's a lot of aspiring people, that's for sure. Google Glass is going to change things. I can't wait to get mine. I'm scheduled here at some point in the near future to go get my Google Glass. I'm curious to see how that's going to change the way video is being created, because if you have, let's just say, 100,000 people with Google Glass going on, you know, that's that can make amazing. Where anytime you can just reach up and click your recording, I think Google Glass will be I got GoPros here in the cabinet that my kids are using. You know, just the GoPro stuff alone has made a big change, and cell phones too. But I'll be curious to see where things are going to move forward to. It's exciting for sure.
Yeah, I think that the big thing, to, you know, from the 30,000 foot view here, is that I think we all are going to be able to get access to much more variety of good content that is a little closer match to what our likes and the types of things that we like to watch and consume and learn from and laugh at. And I think the combination of the broadcast side and the online piece opens up all those doors for all of us to get access to content that we enjoy. And I think that's the big opportunity here. And I think that, you know, these battles that are happening between these platforms that are more limited and proprietary, and, you know, content's going to win in the end. And the audiences are going to go to where they can get the content presented to them in a way that they want to consume it. You know, this whole binge viewing thing, I think, is a perfect example of the audience saying, this is how I want to consume this stuff.
Yep.
It's really up to the platforms and the business models to evolve and adapt to what the audience wants. Now, granted, what the audience wants sometimes isn't what's best for the business models.
Yep.
And that's really where the friction is in space. And the older models, it's a generational thing. I think as those ad buyers and those brands become younger and more in touch with metrics and data, they're going to embrace that more. It's not going to be as much as, we'll keep it, you know, so simple that it's just like it used to be, right? It's going to have to evolve. And I think it's good for the industry. It's good for content providers, because once they start consuming that deeper level of data, then those CPMs are probably going to go up, because they're going to discover ways to more directly reach those audiences and get the results that they need to generate more revenue from them.
You know, Rob, I don't think it's the media buyers themselves issue right now. They are 23, 24, 25 year olds that are actually, okay. You know, they're the ones that are, they're doing the IOs. I think what it is, and I think their bosses are, you know, there's enough time has spanned here that, you know, the okay. average upper manager, maybe 10 or 15 years older. I think they completely understand the space. It's the brands. The brands are
The brands are the problem. Then
I think the brands are the ones that are. In some brands have been much, much more aggressive than others. But I think once some of the old fogies get out of some of the brand marketing and sales and PR spaces of those companies, I think you'll see a big shift. I think in the media companies, though, if I go to a media company today, and walk in and do a yep. pitch, the entire 20 or so people that I may be given a pitch, there's not a person that's 25, older than 20, maybe no one older than 30 in that room. Yeah. So they understand this content. They want to buy it. They just getting the companies to sign off is the biggest challenge.
I got you.
Yeah, I really think that's where the holdup is the, you know, the people in the top offices and these big brands. I mean, Amber, do you have an opinion on that? Do you think maybe that's where, am I anywhere close to being right?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think that it's the brand who has to sign off at the end of the day, that the agencies and the media buyers want big ideas, but to actually have the brand sign off and invest money in it and in their eyes, take that gamble. It still feels like a gamble to them, I think, yeah. Even though we have all the data to back it up and make it an easy yes, it's still a leap of faith for them.
And it's also too, Rob, another thing is they've worked in these constrained, you know, you got a guy that comes in as he's going to be in control of a bot. Let's say he's going to be in control of a brand. He holds the purse strings. The person behind him did the last 2 years, you know, being successful in certain type of advertising. It's very, you know, even sometimes the media buyers are saying, my future rides on me having successful next couple of years. And so they're very, you know, they go very limited in the amount of budget they do as experimental. When something's working, and it's also a lot easier just to redate insertion orders and go spend the money again with the place that happened before. So, but you know, I think
and there's that trust involved of someone you've already used that they delivered on it. So,
And I think trust is a big part of it too. And that's one of the reasons, again, why we signed this big deal with this major media company is because they wanted to have a higher trust factor with the media buyers that are actually spending money in their space. And so anyway, it's interesting. We'll see where it goes. And the money will come. Here we are. It's, you know, I started doing this in 2005 and I thought we'd be much farther along than we are. Much farther.
So is it also a factor of scale too? Is the online piece still not bigger or as big as television to justify that risk taking? I guess that's kind of what was popping into my head.
Well, how many advertisements do you see on TV that are basically telling someone to go buy something and use a promotional code or something like that? Most of the stuff you're seeing on TV,
it's brand,
is brand awareness. Yep. And you know, they're having to use all kinds of crazy math to figure out how much impact they had on brand awareness. So you don't see a lot of brand awareness buys happening in digital. They are go buy this and use this code, or it's more product driven. Yeah. And at some point, when we get into the point where the brands will start using the digital space like they use television space, it'll all change. But until then, it's not going to. I think the volume's there. There's select pockets of volume.
But it's also, I mean, a lot of the brands are struggling right now. And I know, at least in the podcasting area, there's a lot of consolidation happening right now around networks trying to pull together large groupings of high quality shows, right? Well, to aggregate those audiences and to be able to pitch brands and add folks on multi-millions of audience members than just going in and pitching like one show.
It was our best kept secret for many years.
That's right. I think it, you know, I mean, a lot of ways, Todd, you know, the network that you built, the Tech Podcast Network, was one of the earliest in that.
Right. And, you know, and we understood is you had to have, you know, you go to an advertiser and say, I want you to advertise on my show. And I say, well, how many viewers do you have? Well, I have 25,000 per episode. And they're like, go away. You know, they want to do
it. Just doesn't have the scale.
Yeah. Right. They want to do a buy where they can be delivered, you know, 5, 6, 7 million, 10 million impressions a week. Or, yep. You know, so they, you know, it's not, you know, they want multi-millions impressions every week. They don't want small numbers. They write big checks. And national buys do. You know, your local advertising is a whole different topic we spend a whole hour on, but.
Yeah. And the truth of the matter is YouTube has been able to aggregate big numbers like that. And that's why we're seeing them be successful about, you know, monetizing for some of the bigger content providers on that platform.
Well, that was the whole idea of the channels movement, right? Was to up the CPM so that, you know, all waters rise together so that across the entire network, there will be higher revenues paid to folks. But ultimately what they did, I mean, that was a Trojan horse. It was a genius that they gave all of these people money to basically create startups to learn how to use their platform and then kind of leave them high and dry when they didn't figure it out completely.
Yeah. You know, it's like,
you know, any show, and I mean, you know, when I'm advising, you know, folks that are thinking about doing content, you know, it's not an immediate ramp up. It takes, unless you're something happens that really makes something go viral, a general show takes a couple of years really to ramp up. You know, you look at the Gadget Professor that's here at Geek News Central. You know, it took, for the first 6 months, Don was like, oh my God, it's what's going on. The audience says, Don will come. Just keep creating the content, putting it out there. And, you know, now that show is, we're starting to see you know, a dramatic increase in the number, and it's about a year, 3, 4 months where he's been doing the content. It just takes time to build it. First of all, you got to build
consistency.
You got to get the loyalty. You know, there's all those things that go into building an audience. And most people are not, we live in a, you know, 120 character world today. Everyone wants it now.
Well, and that kind of leads into a fascinating question too around consistency, right? So the whole broadcast model has been built on this this paradigm of seasons, right? And if you look at online stuff in YouTube, and podcasting is another example of this, where you start doing a show, you do it every week for years. I mean, both you and I mean, you're a prime example. I mean, you're up to what, 850 episodes of your show?
865,
it's a huge commitment. I would say that's like an absolute mentality shift for traditional media folks into new media. New media folks work really, really hard.
They
don't take a week off. They're always producing content. All these YouTube stars are always shooting videos in every moment of their life because they have to. The demand is so much to consume their content that they are feeding that beast all the time. And it's a huge responsibility to create this world and this audience and this demand, because to your point, it's not a season. You don't do 22 episodes and then take the summer off. You know, it's constant, and you have to keep feeding them. So, you know, it's a lot of hard work. Kudos to you guys.
You know, and I think, you know, the audience, though, I tell people that the audience builds you, aka the content creator, into their lives. If you're producing content and they know there's a new show going to come out Monday and Thursday, they know Tuesday morning they can watch that show, or they can listen Tuesday and Friday morning. They know it's there. They build that. It's a little bit of a mentality thing. So for example, last week, you know, I generally will announce way in advance if I'm going to take a week off. And I don't take many weeks off. I take at most maybe 2 weeks off a year. I used to take none. It was die hard, but I've had to try to you know, find a happy medium where I take a little time off from time to time. So this past Monday night, just things were out of my control. And I got back to the hotel room at about 10:30. Show's got to go on. And I said, sorry, I'm not going to do it, because I'd have been like, you know, slurring my words and it would have been worse content than. So, you know, immediately Tuesday morning, where's the show? Where's the show? What happened? Where's the show? And I'm replying to everybody, sorry, you know, things out of my control. So they become concerned too if there's something missing, even if your content's missing. But they'll forgive you a few times, but you don't want to do that on a regular basis. And it is, you know, yeah. And what happens with us, we watch traditional television and then the season ends and you're like, crap, I got to wait a 6 months for the next.
At least, right?
Yeah. Or a year or more. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it does kind of beg the question, is that as we move into this new kind of more digital age of content creation, is that going to have an impact on what we consider to be kind of traditional professional content on the broadcast side? Are we going to see longer seasons, I guess, is my question. Hmm. Or are we going to see more shows that are just every week, more like a 60 minutes? Even some of those shows are seasoned now, but it's like, you know, are we going to see more of shows like that? Because that's what this audience has been conditioned to be attracted to because of the digital side.
Rob, on the broadcasts, I can't see how they can. They rely on syndication and those rebroadcast fees. That goes into their dollar amounts and their production costs. They know they're going to have so many reruns, they're going to get paid so much money for that. You know, that goes into their model.
May be part of this transition that we're going to have to go through around business models, around that big media content.
Yeah.
It can't stay the same and still fit into this world. I don't believe in the long run.
They want it to stay the same.
I know. Well, that's the friction that we're seeing here, right?
But as you know, a great example of this is, you know, House of Cards, right? Or Arrested Development.
Yeah.
And this binge viewing. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to start releasing entire seasons in order to get that spike of audience. Specifically, you know, on those subscription platforms is where this model seems to be working the best. But I do believe in the YouTube world, if you're going to, like, Video Game High School, Freddie Wong, you know, putting together a 90-minute movie and releasing the episodes, but releasing them all at once. So you are binge viewing. I think that's kind of the new movement right now.
Yeah, cool. I'm going through a binge viewing right now, catching up with Game of Thrones, starting at season one. So
was it the wedding scene that got you going?
When I read the book, the first book, and so the first season to me, you know, it's really kind of Game of Thrones. Don't read a book if you want to watch a television series. Do one or the other, because it totally spoils everything that you see. And they do Game of Thrones so well, and there's so many intricacies. If you read the book, your brain can explode. But you know, imagine if they did Three Shades of Grey as a series. You know, obviously with adult restricted, but it would be, you know, it would be huge. I mean, it would be a huge series, and I can't imagine it's not already coming out as a TV series. But maybe it's just a little.
Probably somebody's working on it, I'm sure.
Yeah, they got to figure out.
Probably come to Showtime or HBO or something.
Yeah, they got to figure out how to keep the rating from going X, I guess. But so I don't know. I it really is frustrating for me as a purveyor of content that likes to watch a lot of content when, you know, I have to wait, you know, a long time for the next series. I think Rob, but the question is, could I handle a whole year? Is there enough content? Would the content suffer if the broadcast people have to go in? There's got to be a new episode every week of the year. I think the content would suffer. I don't think Hollywood can support that.
Well, that's probably a separate question, but I know that there's a lot of TV shows that you know I subscribe to, and it's really disappointing to have the season end. It would be great if they just kept going, you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's interesting.
It's really as simple as that.
So, Amber, we're almost here. We've already been going hour 30 minutes, so don't want to take this much longer than this, or we'll have no one watch this later. go ahead. Just first of all, let's go ahead and pitch your site. You're at Storytech News, and let me put this up on the screen. Storytechnews.tumblr.com. Is this your personal site?
So this is the Storytech where we aggregate everything on our Tumblr, and we just tumble what's right and relevant in tech and content and media. And aggregate it all together for there. It's a product that we actually sell to the networks.
Okay.
It's a good spot for people to check out that kind of, you know, if they're in content, media, and technology.
And is there any other website that we should be looking at for stuff that you're doing?
Yeah, you should subscribe to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/comedygivesback.
Okay, let me type that in. Comedy. I should have had this already.
Gives back.
Okay, there we go. So make sure they get subscribed to this channel. Very, very good.
Yes, please subscribe. This is our 24-hour live stream global comedy event that raises money this year specifically for Peter Chernin's Malaria No More. And Malaria No More is eradicating malaria from the planet by 2015, which is pretty cool.
So you're going to have Adam Carolla. You're going to have Adam Devine. You're going to have Kevin Nealon. I don't know Kevin. I know who Adam Devine and Adam Carolla is. Dan Cook as well is going to be on.
Dan Cook,
yeah.
Oh, okay, yep. So very, very cool. So everyone make sure you get subscribed to this YouTube channel. I'll do that here before we, as a matter of fact, just click subscribe, and I am subscribed. There we go.
Yay, thanks for subscribing. Yeah,
absolutely.
So Amber, that event is on November 6th?
November 6th. It's a Wednesday.
Okay.
And that's the opening night of New York Comedy Festival. And it goes from Australia to London to New York and LA. And we're hubbed out of What's Trending here in Hollywood. So it's kind of a telethon 2.0 where you go to the various places around the country, watch the stand-up show, and then come back to the studio where, you know, people come in and do bits and premiere content, and we raise money for Malaria No More.
Very cool. Well, this is one space so that's hot. Go ahead, Rob.
Oh, I said next week on the show, we have Damian Berger from What's Trending on the show.
Damian Berger, so, he's great.
Yeah, no, he's a great guy. So it'd be fantastic.
Anything else we should have you pitch while you're on?
Well, you can follow at Amber J. Lawson on Twitter.
Okay, Amber J. Lawson on Twitter. Amber J. Lawson. And that's what I should have actually had that in your lower third. So we'll start doing that in the future. Rob, what's on for next week? Well, you actually just told me.
Yeah, I just told you. Damian Berger from What's Trending in the Disrupt Group is going to be on to talk about all of the cool media stuff that he's doing. You know, I mean, he's got a great show on YouTube and was part of that channel program for a while. And now he's moved on from that as well.
If I can get my act together, next week will be our first week that we do this show live on YouTube as well. So it's all set up. I just haven't had a moment to test it. And I want to test it before we do an actual live event on there. But looking forward to doing that. Those of you that have comments on today's show, you can email us here. It's real easy. It's either Todd at newmedia.com or at the newmediashow.com, or yeah. Rob at newmediashow.com as well. Send us your comments on the show, or if you have a suggestion on a guest we should have in the future, let us know of that as well. Rob, looks like my schedule's pretty good. I'm still planning on being out that week of the 24th. So I know we're planning to be off that Saturday, but so next week will be our final show. Then we'll be off a week or two, and depending, I think just off a week. I think that was his current schedule, but looking forward to spending some time back where I grew up and family reunion, class reunion, and then doing some stuff with Ford.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
It's going to be a fun week. But, Amber, thanks for taking time out of your Saturday morning to be on with us. Sure. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. It was great chatting all things new media.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think we ought to have Amber back on at a future date, Rob. I think we could dig deeper into some individual topics. I think you've got a brain full of information there. We have to come back and have you on at a later date. But thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, well, thank you, Amber. It's great to speak with you. You've got so much deep knowledge about this stuff. I think, you know, on the podcasting side, it's great to have these two worlds because they tend to be kind of two worlds kind of come together a little bit.
We're trying to bring them together, too.
Yep.
Yeah, trying to get the folks that are doing the traditional podcast stuff to say, hey, there's a whole nother world out there and vice versa. So, yep. All right, everyone, thanks for being here. We'll see you next time. Todd Cochran here at the New Media Show. Rob?
Yep. Rob at robgreenlee.com, too, if you wanted to reach out to me in an email. And then I'm also at Twitter at Rob Greenlee. So you can reach me there.
Everyone, we'll see you next time. Take care. Aloha.